Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and today we're going to change things up a little bit. I recently sat down with an old friend of mine, Brendan Campisi, very knowledgeable guy, longtime contributor to the show. I think the last time we talked to him was in 2018 when we talked about the residential school system in Canada and the racial apartheid system as it existed in Canada. So when I sat down with him just this past week, I got a chance to interview him again. This was a long time coming. And we talked about the system of apartheid in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, and specifically the history of the Palestinian working class resistance going back all the way to 1900. It was a real tour de force, very long interview. I've had to divide it into three parts. So over the next 3 weeks, you're going to hear each part. The beginning, which we're going to hear today, begins in 1900 with the Ottoman Empire controlling Palestine. Covers the British mandate when the British Empire dominated Palestine, and that goes up to about, and it finishes around the year 1939. The second episode is going to cover from 1939 to roughly 1987. So basically, you know, you have the Nakba, you have the end of British rule in Palestine, and you have the early period of Israeli domination going up to the late 80s. And the final part, is going to cover 1987, First Intifada to today, to the present. So that's what we've got coming up over the next 3 weeks. We're gonna hear all those parts. Today we're gonna hear the first part, covering the genesis of the working class in Palestine, the beginnings of the trade union movement, the beginnings of working of proletarianization in Palestine, and its role in resistance first to the British colonial rule, and ultimately to the Zionist entity, to Israeli apartheid, and how that plays a crucial role going up to today. So it's a really amazing history. I hope you'll stay with me. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to turn it over to that interview right now.
Okay, so you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I'm Siegfried, and an old friend is joining me on the show today. Really happy to have him back on. This is Brendan Campisi, who some of you who are like long time listeners, you may remember him. I'm trying to remember the last time you were on. Actually, it was quite some time ago. I think Brendan, the last time we talked, it was about colonialism in Canada, I believe, settler colonialism in Canada, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm trying to remember when that was exactly, like when we would have been. Maybe that might have been 2018, the last time we spoke,
something like that.
But it's really good to have you on. And of course, well, now, you know, we're talking about Palestine, we're talking about Palestinian resistance. I've done many, many episodes of the show in the last several months, understandably, concerning settler colonialism in Palestine. But I know you've done a lot of, you've looked into this like pretty extensively recently, and we want to delve deeper into, you know, into settler colonialism in Palestine, the impact of apartheid, but also specifically the impact of apartheid on the working class in Palestine, which I don't think this is something that really gets a lot of attention, even in alternative media. This is not something a lot of people really focus on, is what's the dynamic there in Palestine, where you have actual working people who are facing up to conditions of, say, colonialism. Because of course, even before you had the State of Israel, you had, you know, British occupation, British colonialism. Before that, you had, of course, the Ottoman Empire. So even if you want to take it back all the way to 1900, you know, you have a very distinctive kind of situation in Palestine. We see how that evolves over time, where it's now we have a threat of almost, total war breaking out in that region, given how far things have escalated since October 7th of last year. So I guess just kind of set the scene for us and just talk about how did the working class in Palestine really come to be?
Sure. So yeah, basically what I think is interesting here, and what I think is sort of useful to do, is to start within Ottoman society and the way the Ottoman Empire, the late Ottoman Empire, develops. Because I think often, you know, we sort of start Palestinian, you know, history or the history of Palestine when the Zionist settlers start to show up in the late 19th century. And obviously, that's really important. That changes lots of things. But there's also, you know, a process of capitalist development, a process of state formation that's happening in the Ottoman Empire at the same time. So I think basically the starting point here is, so after the Ottoman Empire loses the Crimean War, the Ottoman state is concerned to stimulate economic development, right? They realize that they are industrially, technologically, they're very far behind the Europeans. And that's why they keep losing these wars. And so they take a number of measures in the 1850s and 1860s to try to stimulate economic development. And one of those things is that starting in 1958, they carry out this process of changing land ownership, because basically up to that point, land in the, you know, the Ottoman world, and specifically we're talking about, you know, the Arab world, we'll focus in on Palestine in a minute, but this is characteristic of the whole sort of Ottoman, you know, Ottoman-controlled, you know, Arab East. Land is not a commodity, right? People have access to land in various ways, but there's no market, right? Lots of land is tied up in sort of religious endowments. Some land is held in a kind of feudalism by landowners who are sort of tax farmers for the state. And then a huge amount of agricultural land, and also land used by pastoralists, you know, the Bedouin in places like the Niqab, is held communally. So Palestine does not have, you know, in the mid-19th century, does not have a landless peasantry, right? Most people, the vast majority of people are peasants. Obviously, there's cities like Jerusalem and Hebron and Nablus and Haifa, where there are artisans and merchants and so on. But most people are peasants, and those peasants have access to the land, right? Through various, you know, through various means. And then in 1858, the Ottomans say that land ownership has to be registered. And the effect of this is that it starts to privatize land, because some people, some sort of wealthier landowners, are more able to secure, or, you know, more easily able to secure legal title to land than others, and especially the peasants who are illiterate. Peasants are very suspicious of state, so they don't go register their land. They're afraid that if they register land, they will be taxed more and they will be subject to conscription, right? And they follow the traditional practice of peasants in trying to keep the state as far away from them as possible. So what happens is, from 1858, land starts to become a commodity in, you know, this area of the Ottoman Empire for the first time, basically. And you have people from the landowning class and the merchant class, which sort of develop together, they're sort of convergent, who start for the first time treating land as a productive investment, right? Not something just to extract rent from, but something where you could make production decisions to try to get more profit. They start acting as agricultural capitalists. And they start acting as agricultural capitalists geared towards producing a set of commodities for export to the European market. And so, for example, in Syria, this is, or large parts of what is today Syria, this is tobacco. It's cotton in parts of what is today Syria. It's tobacco in other parts, and it's tobacco in what is today Lebanon. And in Palestine, proverbially, it is citrus fruit, right? The famous Jaffa oranges. And so the very first wage workers in Palestinian society are people who are either working on plantations that are owned by these new, you know, hybrid merchant landowners, or they are people working in the ports in places like Haifa and Jaffa, which are expanding because Palestine now has this prominent export competing on the world market. And you have this process of, you know, basically enclosure, like in other parts of the world, that starts to take place. Well, it takes place very slowly. And in fact, the traditional communal landownership that existed in Palestinian villages, which is called the Mashah, is not completely destroyed until the Nakba. So we're talking about a very long, long process, right, in the sort of, the century, you know, this between the mid-19th and mid-20th centuries, where you start to have enclosure and the growth of wage labor in the Palestinian society. And this is actually the context that allows the Zionist project to happen, because once land goes onto the open market, you know, a few decades later, for totally different reasons, you know, entirely rooted in Europe, you have, European Jewish philanthropists who start buying estates in Palestine from these landowners, many of whom live outside of Palestine. You know, this becomes very important in the sort of Arab historical narrative here, is that basically a bunch of rich absentee landlords in Beirut sold Palestine to the Zionists. And there's a lot of truth to that, actually. Basically because, once again, you have these landowners who come to see the land mainly as an investment. So if, you know, selling to, you know, the Jewish National Fund or its predecessor organizations is a better financial decision than, you know, keeping this estate, cultivating it, exporting the oranges from it and whatnot, then that's what they would do. And so from the 1880s, you have plantations that are now owned by Jewish, landowners from Europe who have a vague sense of some kind of Zionist project they might want to carry out. But they're not really establishing a settler society, right? They are doing the same sort of things that European settlers in other parts of Africa and Asia in this period are doing, where they're basically buying plantations and native workers are living there. So at this point, it makes very little difference if you're a, you know, Palestinian worker working on one of these citrus plantations, whether your landlord happens to be part of the same culture as you are, you know, living in his mansion in Beirut, or is a European Jew. But then once you get into the actual sort of ideologically motivated and rigorously organized, you know, Zionist settler project, that changes things, because those people actually want to create an entirely separate Jewish economy. And that has, you know, a different set of effects on the Palestinian population, obviously.
Right. So, yeah, this seems like a very, very slow start in a lot of ways to, you know, you could say like Palestinian proletarianization and displacement compared to, say, like other parts of the world. But I'm assuming like Zionism, when it comes onto the scene, and you actually start to have, you know, Europeans coming in larger and larger numbers to Palestine, this I'm assuming this changes the equation dramatically for the Palestinian working person.
Yes, absolutely. And the key development here is around the turn of the century, which is the period that sort of in the history of the Zionist project is known as the Second Aliyah. The First Aliyah is sort of again, these sort of proto-Zionist, you know, you have like French, you know, members of the Rothschild family who feel bad. They feel sorry for the Jews in the Russian Empire. And so they get this idea that they can fund these settlements there. The Second Aliyah is organized by young, mainly, you know, socialist Zionists from the Russian Empire itself. And they create institutions like the kibbutzim, right? These communal agricultural settlements. And they... basically, they recognize that the Zionist colonial project, if it's going to work, cannot be like other European colonial projects, right? They realize that it's never going to be a convincing economic proposition to get people to move from Europe, even from Eastern Europe, into, you know, into the third world, right? Nobody's calling it that yet, but into an underdeveloped society, if they have to compete economically with the people who are already there. Right. There's no way that, you know, the Europeans who they wanted to move to Palestine to establish the Jewish state would compete on a free labor market with Palestinian peasants right out of the villages. They simply wouldn't be able to do it. They wouldn't be willing to do it. So in order to make the Zionist project viable, they recognized, and the future, you know, founder of the Israeli state, David Ben-Gurion, is already sort of one of the protagonistic figures here. Ben-Gurion and the people around him realize that they have to create an autonomous Jewish economy where there is no competition on the labor market between Jews and Arabs. There's also sort of a socialist fig leaf to this, where they say, oh, well, you know, of course, we don't want to exploit the Arab laborers like these, you know, these Rothschild philanthropists are doing. And there's a degree of sincerity to that. Zachary Lofman, who's a great historian of this, makes the point that even if, you know, socialist Zionists, socialism and their Zionism are logically and incompatible in the real world, it doesn't mean they don't in some way believe in both. But putting that to one side, so around 1900, they start creating a separate Jewish economy. And that means that once, you know, the Zionist institutions purchase a plot of land, then they actually start evicting the Palestinian Arab peasants from that land, right? And this is the actual beginning of, you know, the so-called Israeli-Palestinian conflict, right? It's around the year 1900 when Palestinian peasants start to realize that this new group of people coming in to their country are not like all the various other foreigners who come to Palestine for various other purposes, and that they are... that they pose a greater problem for their way of life. And, you know, you have violence that starts in the countryside in northern Palestine, actually in the 1890s. But also you have the beginning of, or the an acceleration of that process of proletarianization, because you have people who are being displaced from their villages, you know, displaced from their land, evicted from it, And they can't necessarily find agricultural land, you know, elsewhere. And so they start, or again, more of them start becoming, you know, free-floating proletarians. And then the other crucial development in terms of, you know, the acceleration of capitalist development and proletarianization in Palestine is that, oh, I should also say, just to get a little bit more into the Zionist project here. So not only are they establishing settlements and evicting people, especially the left-wing Zionists say that no Jewish employer in Palestine can employ Arab labor, and no Jewish settlers in Palestine can buy Arab products. And they carry out campaigns within the Jewish settler community to impose these things, to impose the policies of Hebrew labor and Hebrew goods, right? And that's the form that the class struggle takes within, you know, the Zionist settler society in Palestine in this period, is that you have plenty of Jewish capitalists who've come to Palestine and who want to exploit Palestinian labor because it's very cheap. And then you have these, you know, these socialist Zionist activists who are picketing, you know, their farms and their businesses, you know, burning, you know, destroying their goods in the markets and so on, in order to impose on them the policy of hiring Jews. Because the only way that their self-contained economy can work is if, you know, Jewish settler employers only hire Jewish settler labor, and the Jewish settler public only buys goods produced within that economy. And again, even though they're you know, socialists in a certain sense, this can also only work with extensive subsidy from the outside, because again, it isn't profitable. The crucial thing about the Zionist project compared to other colonial projects is that it's not driven by profitability, right? You do not have people going from Poland and Hungary and Germany to Palestine mainly because they want to make money. They do it for the self-professed ideological purpose, because they believe that it is necessary to save and redeem the Jewish people. And so that means throughout the history of the Zionist project and into the Israeli state, as we'll get into, they do all kinds of things that are not profitable, because that is not their, you know, that's really not their animating factor. It's a remarkable case of the, you know, the autonomy of politics, you know, from economic relations. And I was going to get into talking about the British and what they do, but I'll pause there.
Yeah, because obviously we really want to get into that. I mean, that's pretty much the important next step. And we're already seeing the beginnings of apartheid here, you know, in terms of like this dynamic, you know, and like obviously not, you know, this whole like, you know, you only buy and sell to Jews and things like that, right? Only to the settlers. You know, only hiring settler labor. But obviously, you know, then you have the Balfour Declaration, you have the British occupation and the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. And this is when Zionism is really starting to, you know, accelerate.
Yes. And the British also, even independently of their sponsorship of the Zionist project, do a number of things that spur capitalist development in the way that the Ottoman state, even though they wanted to, the Ottoman state simply didn't have the capacity to do. So, as you said, the British occupy Palestine in 1918, and they govern it until 1948. And during that time, they do a number of things. First of all, on the economic sphere, basically pick favorites. They decide that, you know, state economic policy is going to help the economic development of the Jewish settler society and not of Palestinian Arab society. They do virtually nothing to help the Palestinian agricultural economy develop. That's actually putting it very charitably. In many ways, they undermine it. But at the very least you can say is that the British do not help Palestinian agriculture develop, and they certainly do not help any kind of Palestinian industry develop, right? But they do help the industrial economy that develops in the Zionist settler society and the agricultural one, right? They facilitate the continued purchase of land. Although it should be noted that, you know, up to 1948, you know, the Zionist movement is only able to purchase a very small portion of the agricultural land in Palestine. Most of it would have to be seized, you know, at gunpoint. But nonetheless, they do purchase a great deal more land under the mandate. It's, you know, obviously very helpful, you know, to the project. And they're able to build up, you know, entirely new cities like Tel Aviv. And the British also give basically any sort of government contract you can think of, virtually all of them, go to, you know, entrepreneurs, manufacturers, what have you, from the Jewish settler community, rather than, you know, any Palestinian Arab who might be, you know, might be in a position to take advantage of those things. So they really, the British really put their fingers on the scale beyond the obvious point that they are now allowing, you know, Jewish migration into Palestine organized by the Zionist movement on a much higher scale than the Ottomans did. And this is especially the case during, you know, from, 1933 to about 1938. Through the whole 1930s, you have this massive wave of migration. But we'll get to that in a second. Also, just in terms of their own strategic interests, the British expand the railway system in Palestine substantially. They build up a modern postal system, and they go all out in developing the port of Haifa. In fact, you know, one of the main reasons the British actually took over Palestine, which of course was not for love of the Jewish people, was because the port of Haifa was one of the decisive nodes of the Middle East, and they wanted it to be part of this sort of, you know, if you think about where Haifa is, you know, and you think about where the Suez Canal is, you think about where the oil fields are in Iraq, which the British had taken over at the same time, and then sort of the passages to India, and then, you know, other things that are under British control at this point, like Gibraltar and Cyprus. You can see how Haifa, this really, really important, you know, this wonderful, you know, port in an ecological, natural sense, sits at a very important sort of location in this whole network of British power in the Mediterranean, in the Middle East, and then, you know, heading over towards South Asia, which is the strategic center. All British strategic decisions for 100 years are made with India in mind. And so with India and, you know, the oil fields in Iraq and all these things in mind, they expand the port of Haifa substantially. Why I'm talking about all this is that, of course, an expanded railway system and an expanded port, the port of Jaffa also grows, but it's not nearly as decisive, you know, in the British imagination as Haifa is. You know, an expanded port system. Eventually, there's an oil refinery in Haifa because the British build a network of pipelines from those oil fields in Iraq that I mentioned to Haifa. And that becomes operative only in the 1940s. But I think there's already some refining going on earlier on. All this infrastructure, of course, requires a huge amount of labor. And of course, you know, you have many, you know, skilled industrial workers coming from Eastern Europe, Eastern and Central Europe, as part of the Zionist project. So of course, many Jewish people work in these enterprises. But also all of this really stimulates the growth of a Palestinian Arab working class. And basically Haifa and Jaffa become the centers of this developing class. And I say developing because in many ways, it's still very closely connected to the Palestinian peasant society. Right? You don't have mass migration into these cities, right? You maybe have, you know, you have one or two, you know, men from a Palestinian peasant family who remain on their land, and, you know, maybe one or two, you know, brothers in this family go to Haifa to work in the docks or to work in this refinery once it opens. And they may actually be doing this in a seasonal way, right? They may spend part of the year in the village and part of the year working in Haifa or Jaffa, or they may spend some years working in Haifa or Jaffa, save up some money, and then go back to the village, right? So the Palestinian Arab working class, such as it is still very, very closely connected to the, you know, the Palestinian peasant society, which is still, you know, 2/3 of the population up to the time of the Nakba. But you do also have, you know, these large-scale industrial workplaces, especially there was a railway hub in Haifa that was the largest industrial workplace in Palestine, probably one of the largest industrial workplaces in the Middle East at this time, because the oil industry was just, you know, just really in its infancy in the Gulf and Iran. And you have large numbers of both Arab and Jewish workers. I should say, I'm not going to talk about this too much, but during this period, you also have migrant workers coming into Palestine from Syria. Particularly this region in Syria called Haran, and even from Egypt. So you have these sort of wider, you know, Middle Eastern networks of labor migration and so on. But eventually the British decided that's too subversive. It's too easy for people to spread anti-colonial Arab nationalist ideas if you have people moving around between the colonies too much. So the British and French, I think, sort of shut that down at a certain point. But you do have a large migration from the northern Palestinian countryside, especially into Haifa, and you have the development. Haifa becomes this sort of segregated colonial city where up on the hill you have the European settler neighborhoods, and then down by the port you have the development of a Palestinian working class area. It's basically sort of the first cohesive proletarian, you know, social space in Palestine. And that is where efforts to actually organize this emerging class are going to start.
Yeah, because that's what we're going to get into now. Like, we're starting to, I'm assuming we saw various iterations of working class resistance back in the Ottoman days. But I mean, obviously, that's going to accelerate along with the acceleration of exploitation and the acceleration of colonialism and, you know, and the settlers coming in and whatnot. So, yeah, because you have increased efforts by this expanding working class to assert itself, to resist the exploitation that it's facing. And, of course, this is leading up to the actual Arab revolt in the 1930s in Palestine.
Yeah. So basically from about the 1920s, you do have efforts to organize this emerging class. And there are sort of three different groups that all for their own different reasons, you know, have an interest in doing this. Some of the earliest efforts, and this might be surprising, actually come from the Zionist movement. Because, again, you know, during this period, you know, the period of the Balfour Declaration, the period of a new wave of migration from Eastern Europe that takes place after World War I, you have this remarkable sort of institutional consolidation of the Zionist movement, right? The British create the British and the Zionist movement set up the Jewish Agency, which is sort of a Jewish proto-state in Palestine. You have the formation or sort of the formalization of the Jewish National Fund. And you also have the organization of the Labor Federation of the Zionist movement, the Histadrut, right? Which is, it is a trade union for the Jewish workers in Palestine. It is also an institution of the colonial project, right? It helps organize the, you know, because it's both a trade union and an employer, and eventually becomes sort of the core of the Israeli welfare state. It has some of those functions already before statehood. It's a multifaceted institution that basically serves to mobilize and allocate the labor required for the development of the Zionist society. But it is also a trade union representing workers in their workplaces. And basically, the socialist Zionists, you know, and labor Zionists who organize the Histadrut recognize that more Palestinian Arab workers are doing wage labor, and they see this as an opportunity for them because they're, you know, in their worldview, nationalism on the part of the Palestinian Arabs was basically an inorganic thing, right? And I should, you know, to sort of remind the listener, you know, in 1920 and 1921, you have outbreaks of violence between the two, you know, national groups across Palestine, right? So there is a growing sense that, you know, there is this anger, you know, there is this resentment among the Palestinian Arab people that their country has been taken over, and that, you know, it's being settled, it's being colonized. But to the labor Zionists, the socialist Zionists, they believed basically that the Palestinian Arab masses were not so bad. And they didn't really, you know, they didn't really oppose the colonial project. They were being manipulated into doing it by their leaders, right? By the landowners, the elites, the clerics, maybe even by the British in some interpretations. And so they believed that, that this could happen because the Palestinians were peasants and they were backward, right? They'd sort of absorbed, you know, the orthodox Marxist view of, you know, workers having a broad perspective and peasants being, you know, necessarily sort of backward and isolated in their view of the world. So they believed that the development of a Palestinian working class was a good thing, as long as the nefarious, you know, misleading forces of nationalism were not able to convince the Palestinian Arab workers that they should oppose Zionism. And the material basis for their efforts to do this are the fact that in some places you do have, you know, Jewish and Arab workers in the same workplaces. This is, again, the crucial site of this is that railway hub in Haifa. So the Zionist movement sets up an institution that would be a subordinate section of the Histadrut. And this takes a number of names over the course of its history. Eventually, it comes to be called the Palestine Labor League, and so that's what I'll refer to it as. And so the Palestine Labor League makes a very concerted attempt to organize Palestinian Arab workers through the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And the remarkable thing about this is that, you know, it's important to remember this is a very embryonic class. You have people who are just getting into wage labor for the first time. They don't have a deep history of it. They don't have a tradition of it. And they don't have a tradition of working class organizing at all. It's just coming into being, you know, from the 1920s. And generally speaking, workers in that situation are willing to join whatever organization they think will help them. And so you have Palestinian Arab workers joining the unions that the Zionist movement has set up for them. But it only goes so far, because the more active a particular group of Palestinian Arab workers became within this union structure, the more engaged they were with it, they would eventually reach a point where they started asking questions about, well, what is this institution? Is this just a union, right? There were really, really intense efforts to build a railway workers union in Palestine for both the Jewish and Arab workers. The communists were also active in this, and I'll get to them in a second. And it fell apart several times, basically because eventually the most active, the most politically conscious Palestinian workers who were involved asked, you know, the Jewish organizers, but isn't this union part of the Histadrut? Isn't this part of the Zionist colonial project? Have you basically deceived us into thinking that this is just an ordinary trade union? And many of the, you know, the Zionist labor activists who were involved in organizing Palestinian workers were usually people from the left wing of the movement who had a sincere belief in the possibility of cooperation between the two nationalities, and who really did believe that they were bringing progress and development and socialism to Palestine in a way that the Arab masses would be able to benefit from. And so it was very challenging for them to be sort of called out on this, right? The idea that they had basically lied, you know, to their constituency, who they had in fact been serving as, you know, effective trade union representatives for up to a certain point. So again, it's that question about the autonomy of politics, right? This is sort of the theme of Zachary Lockman's excellent book, Comrades and Enemies, is that you do have trade union cooperation between Jewish and Arab workers under the mandate. Because when people are in a workplace together, to a degree, they have common interests and they will work together. That's inevitable in some way. But it never overrode the national question, right? The question of whose country is this and whose country is this going to be was always, you know, in the background. So that's the Zionist movement and their efforts to organize the Palestinian working class. You also have the communists. Now, the Palestinian Communist Party, or the Palestine Communist Party, I should say, was formed by Jewish settlers who had, you know, people who'd been affected by the Russian Revolution, and they had they'd come to Palestine, you know, generally under the auspices of a Zionist project, but had then become disillusioned with it for various reasons. In many cases, they were disillusioned by, you know, by its obvious racism and its obvious colonial character once they saw what it meant on the ground in Palestine. And so they form a dissident current within the Jewish community in Palestine initially. The Comintern, of course, tells them they have to recruit Palestinian Arabs to their party. And they make strenuous efforts to do so. And they also advocate, you know, organizing these workers. And they try to build, you know, inter-ethnic unions. And they have some success in doing so. But up to a certain point, we are still talking about a Jewish party that is able to attract some Arab supporters rather than, you know, a genuinely inter-ethnic party. And we'll talk about what that means a little bit later down the road. And then also you have the conservative Palestinian elite that tries to organize the workers. Because again, you know, workers are not going to leap into radicalism and militancy, you know, at their, you know, in their infancy as a class. So the very first organization of Palestinian Arab workers that's sort of independent is a group called the Palestine Arab Workers Society that's formed in Haifa in 1925. And it is basically a mutual benefit organization, right? That's the form that trade unionism takes at its birth in most, you know, developing capitalist societies, you know. And it also provides, you know, sort of legal assistance, right? The Palestine Arab Workers Society at its birth, although it becomes something different later on, is essentially a way by which philanthropically minded members of the Palestinian elite are able to, you know, provide certain services for, you know, the developing Palestinian Arab workers. It has a loose association with the nationalist project. And in fact, some radical nationalists like Izzedine Al-Qassam, he is actually the leader of the imam of a mosque in this working class neighborhood in the port of Haifa. And he becomes an influential figure in circles around the Palestine Arab Workers Society for a period of time. So that's the situation. It's very, very complicated. And, you know, through the 1920s and 30s, as you have more Palestinian Arabs who are working, you know, on the docks, on the railroads, there's a lot of quarrying, as well as, you know, the older workforce on the farms, you do sort of have a growing frequency of strikes, although again, nothing, you know, really intense, nothing really dramatic. Most of these workplaces are still quite small, etc. And you have this pattern where basically the workers will turn to whoever seems like can provide the most resources, you know, at a given time, up to a certain point. And then eventually you have these ideological, you know, divisions that eventually manifest themselves. And that becomes especially important in the context of the revolt, as you in the late 1930s, as you mentioned.
Yeah, because I mean, the revolt when it took place was still mainly rooted in the peasantry, and say you could say more the traditional society of Palestine. I understand it. So, what role did this rising working class play in the revolt?
Well, that's a really good question, actually, because in some ways, while the revolt eventually becomes, you know, a national uprising that's based on the peasantry, especially in its armed phase, it actually starts with a general strike. And I mentioned Izzedine Al-Qassam, who was a Syrian-born religious leader and religious educator, who had actually sort of traveled the region fighting colonialism. He may have volunteered to fight the Italians when they invaded Libya in 1911, although that's not 100% certain. And he fought the French in Syria after World War I. And then after the rebellions there were defeated, he had to go into exile in Palestine. And he becomes a popular religious leader with a constituency of workers and peasants. And he is killed, I think, in late 1935, at the beginning of an attempt to start the armed struggle. And to give some context here, you know, during the 1920s, or during the later 1920s, the Zionist project in Palestine was facing some pretty severe problems, right? They were actually losing more, new immigrants every year than they were retaining. And again, it's not that surprising, because it's not really an easy proposition for, you know, a shopkeeper in Warsaw or a clerk in Berlin to move to a third world country and become a farm worker, right? There were very few European Jews who were that committed to Zionist ideology that they were really willing to stick it out in Palestine for a long period of time. It was a hard place to live. It was much harder than living in Europe. And then things change very dramatically, because of course the Great Depression takes place, and the Great Depression precipitates a, you know, massive reactionary wave, a massive wave of violent, you know, anti-Semitic nationalism across Europe. This is obviously, you know, most importantly the case in Germany and Austria, but it's also the case in Poland, which has the world's largest Jewish population at that time. You have a huge shift to the right in Polish society during this time. You have a wave of anti-Semitic violence. By the mid-1930s, the Polish government is telling people to boycott Jewish businesses. And then, you know, basically boycott rallies almost inevitably turn into, you know, pogroms. They turn into naked violence in the streets. So in this context, you have tens of thousands of European Jews who may not be ideologically committed Zionists, but who need somewhere to go. And because the settler states in the rest of the world during the Great Depression were not taking in immigrants, Canada wasn't taking in immigrants, United States, I don't know the policy details for places like Australia or Argentina or what have you, but the Great Depression makes the immigrant receiving countries of the world very reluctant to take in immigrants of any kind. And of course, anti-Semitism in those societies makes them very reluctant to take in European Jews. Basically, Palestine becomes the refuge of last resort for a huge population of Jews from Central and Eastern Europe, who are under threat from the rising anti-Semitic wave, of this period. And many of these people are middle class, right? Or, they're professionals, they're small business owners. They bring by the mid-1930s, you have tens of thousands of new Jewish immigrants coming into Palestine every year. And many of them, especially the ones who are coming from, coming from Germany, but also from Poland, are middle-class people with fairly significant assets that they're able to bring to Palestine with them. And so the autonomous Jewish economy takes off, right? We've talked about, the labor Zionists wanted to create an autonomous Jewish economy. That's actually a struggle that goes on through the 1930s, right? It starts around 1900, but there were still plenty of Jewish employers who wanted to use Arab labor. And that continues to happen. It's an ongoing struggle within the community over whether this policy of Hebrew labor is actually going to be successful. But this influx of capital, right, that comes with these new immigrants basically floats the Jewish economy in Palestine, even in the context of the World Depression, right? And so there's a great deal of investment that goes on in the autonomous Jewish economy. And the policy of Hebrew labor becomes a lot easier to enforce. And so, as the great Palestinian Marxist intellectual, activist, artist, Ghassan Kanafani describes in his brilliant analysis of the revolt, you have a real sort of aggravation of this zero-sum situation where the influx of new people and new wealth into the Jewish, settler population in Palestine is a zero-sum game. It takes away from the Palestinian Arab population. Some more land is being taken away, jobs are being taken away, and investment is flowing into, the Zionist economy rather than the Palestinian economy. And so this, there's still a debate among historians about, the precise sort of dollars and cents, and whether there are other, obviously, the Great Depression affected the Palestinian peasants, right? Nobody, the prices of agricultural commodities are collapsing, becomes very difficult. And that would affect the port workers as well, because there's less international trade and so on. So of course, the global depression creates pressure on the Palestinian masses as well. But then they can see right in front of them that there is this completely separate economy from which they are excluded. They have no way of benefiting from that is, mushrooming before their eyes. And so that sort of is the tinder, that sparks this revolt, right? As well as, of course, the desire for independence. From the day the British took over, the Palestinian Arab people wanted independence. They wanted the mandate canceled. They wanted the Balfour Declaration canceled. There's no ambiguity about that whatsoever. But it's the context of economic crisis and the growth and the consolidation of the settler society that creates the conditions for the revolt. So when Kassam and his followers, or a few of his followers, are killed by the British trained police, their funerals turn into a mass nationalist demonstration. And then a few months later, a general strike begins. And this starts with the working class, and then it becomes this sort of, the kind of strike that often takes place in dependent countries, basically where business people go on strike too. Right, because the animating factor of it is national, right, rather than a specific sort of class demand. Although, actually, also notably, there are certain sectors of the economy where the general strike is weaker. The most important one of these is the railways, because over the years, the Palestinian workers in that sector had actually forged very good relationships with their Jewish co-workers. So they were. I say there was a broad nationalist consensus, of course, in the Palestinian population. But the Palestinian railway workers are basically less willing to make immediate sort of material sacrifices for the national cause, because they don't really have the same, quite the same perception, quite the same relationship to, you know, the issue of settler colonialism that most other sections of Palestinian society have. Eventually, I think they do join in the strike. And then, of course, you know, the progress of the revolt is complex. You know, the strike puts a huge amount of pressure on the British, and they start negotiating with the sort of moderate elite nationalists. The Arab kings encourage the, you know, the Palestinian elite to take a deal from the British. And then they do take that deal and the British renege on it. And then you get into the second phase of the revolt, which is, as you said, an armed insurrection that is based on the peasantry. And this is really a remarkable event. There's not really a revolt in the British Empire on the same scale in the interwar period, basically after, the end of the war in Ireland in 1921. Basically, this is the most intense challenge that British rule faces anywhere in the world between the wars. They have to send 100,000 soldiers to Palestine to defeat it. They kill and imprison thousands of people. You know, the Palestinian national's leaders are all sent into exile, right? They're sent to, you know, places like the Seychelles, right? Very, very far away from Palestine, of course. And they pioneer a number of the repressive technologies that Israel uses to this day, like home demolitions, like holding entire villages and family groups collectively responsible for, you know, resistance actions, all of these things. So it really is an extraordinary, and they train a military force from within the Zionist community that basically, you know, helps them with this repression. And that is basically the embryonic cell of the IDF, right? The Zionists have been creating armed forces for decades because, again, you know, there is some violence, you know, on the, you know, the boundary zones between the areas that they're settling and the Palestinian villages, you know, even in the 1890s. But the British helped them sort of create a formal military structure with training and equipment in order for them to defeat the Arab revolt. And the, you know, the young, you know, the young people who helped the British doing that are the future commanders of the Israeli military, right? They're people like Moshe Dayan, people like Yitzhak Rabin, the people who would lead the IDF in carrying out the Nakba. As Kanafani points out, the way that the revolt is defeated basically makes the later defeat of the Palestinians, you know, inevitable, because there was no way that they could have recovered, you know, a military organization, a political organization, after, you know, repression that's this severe. And the revolt also has two other consequences that we'll talk about before moving on to the period of Second World War. One is that it creates an extremely difficult situation for the Palestine Communist Party. The Palestine Communist Party, as I mentioned, had been under pressure from the Comintern to become an Arab party. Right. And especially during the third period, you know, of the international communist movement, when anti-colonialism is really, really heavily emphasized, they really do go all out trying to recruit Arab, members. And there is a certain cohort of young Arab intellectuals and you know, working class activists in certain sectors who are attracted to the Palestine Communist Party. And then when the revolt breaks out, it's very difficult for the party to know what to do, because while the main focus of the revolt is the British, it does also become, you know, a conflict between the Palestinian population and the Jewish settler population. And it creates an enormous amount of tension between Jewish and Arab communists. Initially, the party takes part in the armed struggle, or at least some Arab members are taking part in the armed struggle when it breaks out. But the Jewish members are not happy about this. They basically can't swallow it. And they start to break off. They form for the first time an autonomous Jewish section of the Palestine Communist Party. And then later during the war, as we'll see, or the Second World War, the two groups would end up rupturing entirely. And the other thing that goes on during the revolt is that ordinary trade union activity in Palestine ceases completely. And then things would change very, very dramatically after the defeat of the revolt and then the outbreak of the Second World War.
You keep me in my head and you pick them down. And you don't serve the people.
When the generator's on, till the cops said move around.